Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing as well as the writing life and video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA by going to pnwa.org. Well, if you like compelling narratives, lyrically told, you need look no further than today's guest, Mr. Frank Delaney. But in addition to being a crackerjack writer, Frank is also a bit of a teacher, whether he knows it or not, although I think he does. Now, he teaches in many ways, in part by some of the bits of wisdom he has distilled down into essentially one-sentence reminders, which I have found on the Facebook, and we're going to talk about today. But he is also a teacher, I think, and perhaps his greatest teaching skill is his enthusiasm. Frank, in my experience, throws himself wholeheartedly and unapologetically into whatever it is he loves to do. And for me, there is nothing more inspiring than watching someone do something they love, whether that something is what I would like to do or not. It reminds me why life is worth living and worth living fully. And so I am just thrilled to have him on the show with me today. And Frank, welcome to Author.
Bill, it's so nice of you to invite me back. I've enjoyed my last visits immensely. This is just terrific.
If in fact, for our guest curiosity, Frank was my very first guest on the show, and this is now the fourth time, which makes you my most, fourth time I've interviewed you, period, in my experience on Author Magazine, which makes you my most interviewed guest, Frank. Did you know that?
People will begin to talk.
They will. Well, so Frank, let us begin by letting folks know, if they want to run out and get a Frank Delaney book, what they should start with. Should they begin with The Last Storyteller? This is the third in a trilogy, or should they go back?
They can. The point about writing a trilogy and the way I structured it is you don't have to have read the other two books, and yet if you have read them, there's still enough suspense to keep you going and a lot more to go around after that. Yes, obviously, if you're going to read the trilogy, you start with Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show, then go on to The Matchmaker of Ken Mayer, and then The Last Storyteller. I get a lot of requests from people who come across me for the first time saying, where should I start? And the novel by which I'm best known in the United States is a big novel called Ireland, a Novel, which was published in 2005, and which quite recently, especially in the West Coast, sells at the rate of around 1,000 copies a week. So
really?
It's still, we've just discovered this recently, in all this new transparency in the book world, we've discovered that it's been selling at the rate of 1,000 copies a week, which is very gratifying. But people like it, Bill, because it's about narrative. It's about storytelling. It's also it's almost self-regarding, if you know what I mean. In that case, it's almost sui generis, in
right.
that it's a storyteller talking about telling stories. And people, and you know this yourself, people love being told a story.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do, Frank. Because I'm going to have to find who said this, and maybe you know, but I've said it a few times on the show. It was a poet who said it. I forget her name. But it is this: the universe is not made of atoms, it is made of stories.
And I think, what a great quote.
Human beings are concerned, that is absolutely, and not even an exaggeration, it is absolutely true, I think.
It's true. It's completely true. And you know this yourself. If you've got people around, if you've got a cookout going on, if you've got people at dinner, or the people hanging out over your kitchen table, and you say, listen, I've got a story to tell you, you have everybody's attention.
Nothing makes me happier.
I know, it's
one of the strangest things. One of the strange things about my wife's family, they don't like to have stories told. My wife loves it. My family
loves
it. For some reason, I can't tell them a story. Isn't that strange? It's the only people I've ever met. It's bizarre.
I wonder why.
I don't know, but my wife has told me I'm not to discuss it with her. So I don't. But I love a story. If someone tells me they have a story to tell me, I'm so happy.
And you can't actually resist it. I come from a society where everything is conveyed in narrative. And to my astonishment, my wife, who was born and raised in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
on Park Avenue and 65th Street, conveys everything in narrative. She tells story too.
Yeah.
And she's a WASP. I mean, her family came over. She says they didn't come over in the first boat, but they're on the second one, very close behind. And her parents, both her parents, from totally different cultures, one a Germanic culture, one an English culture,
yeah.
told stories all the time, as
yeah.
does she. And there must be... I've also always thought, Bill, that it's one of the essentials of our lives, that we have to have story, that story is a means of saving our souls. Remember the wonderful Elizabeth Barrett Browning line, oh God, if there is a God, save my soul if I have a soul. Well, the way of saving your soul, I think, one of the ways of saving your soul is through story. I've seen
yeah.
it happen over and over.
Yeah. Well, it's our way of framing it, story, because, and you know, so the storyteller can't tell it all, right?
I mean, that's right.
You can
50%.
Only show a fragment of what is actually happening.
Yeah.
And
I always say it's a
maximum. In those details that you choose, you are
yeah.
framing reality into
I always say it's a maximum of 50%. That you
yeah,
do,
most.
You the writer, you the novelist, you the storyteller,
yeah.
you do a maximum of 50%.
Yeah.
And the rest is the audience's creation. I'm
yeah.
careful, for example, about not describing character in full detail.
Ah, very good. What a segue. That was going to be one of my first... Now, let me find it. Let me find it. Yes. Use little description of your characters. Now, these are one of Frank's... What do you call them? What are you going to call these? Just tips?
I call them writing tips. I do a writing tip every day on the internet. So far, there have been 1,000 of them over the last couple of years. And I try never to repeat myself. But these are things, these are just shorthand household hints for the working author, so to speak. You could call them.
They're just excellent. And you just mentioned one of my favorite. This is something you and I talked about in our very first interview. And
right.
and it's use little description of your characters. Let the reader do it. So why I know that to be true. How did you learn that?
I learned it by reading. I'm very fond of reading thrillers. And I know why I'm very fond of reading thrillers. Because the appeal of the thriller or the mystery is that everything is tied up neatly at the end.
Yeah.
And it helps you get your life in order. You follow its pattern, and at the end of it all, things are nicely tied up with a ribbon and a bow, and everything is settled. So one of the people I used to read a lot of was an English writer called Graham Greene.
Oh, God. The original thriller writer, in a way, wasn't
Absolutely.
He?
Very, wrote The Third Man.
Yep.
All kinds of... Brighton Rock, all kinds of wonderful books. In fact, one of them was recently filmed, the one set in Vietnam, The Quiet American,
with
Brendan
sure.
Fraser and Michael Caine. If you read Greene had a very, very good English education, and it doesn't waste a lot of emotion, but the work is very spare. And if you read his characters, the description of them is so spare as to be almost non-existent. For example, he wrote a very powerful novel about an illicit love affair called The End of the Affair. And the only thing you know about this immense love object, played by Julianne Moore in the film, this immense love object is, one, she has a habit of laying her hand on the arm of the person she's speaking to, and two, when she lay down, her dark hair spilled back around her head like a pool.
Right.
And that's all you know about her. That's the only description.
Those are the only details.
Those are the only details.
Wow.
So, she therefore, when you're reading the book, becomes your character.
Yeah.
She's yours. She's yours to keep.
Yes, and
that's
fabulous. It is, and I think it's so important to understand, for me, I'm always looking for clues about sort of how the human animal works. And for instance, you know, the old trope that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But you see, so if you tell me, for instance, that a woman is beautiful, and just say that, or you tell me that the character found, you know, the protagonist found this woman to be beautiful.
Yes.
Then, and that's all. Maybe you say she's a brunette or blonde, whatever. But if you keep it to the minimum details, I know beauty. I know my perception of beauty. And I will fill
sure.
it in. But if you say he found her to be beautiful: colon, and then list her eyes and her lips and her cheek. And to me, that has never meant anything to me, because first of all, how do I know what you find, you the writer, or you you're the character finds to be beautiful, is what I find to be beautiful. It's never translated to me.
And if you do that, the more detail you set up in the reader, the more you set up a resistance.
Because they want to make up their own mind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because that's why they once you buy a book, you own that story, so to speak.
Yes.
And you therefore have the rights to every description in that story.
That's right.
And that's why the author must take very great care.
That's right. What do we say? We say we're telling a story, but we also say we are sharing a story, don't we?
That's right. That's right.
And
you want them, you want them to know the story. I mean, most plots are fairly simple. Plot is not really the issue. Boy meets, the standard plot is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy wins girl back.
That's correct.
That's,
beginning,
that's
middle,
the
end.
Plot. Absolutely. Right. That is the standard plot. And boy might be an oil well, or it might be, you know, attractive land or whatever. But it's about loss. It's about acquisition, loss, and regain.
Yes.
By and large, that is the basic structure with which we all work. Now,
sure.
if you then consider that what writing is the coloring in of the rest of those squares, that's where the care begins. That's where the professional writer starts his work. And you have to be careful with the colors you use.
That's right. You have to be very deliberate. What did Nabokov say? He said, caress the divine detail, didn't he?
He did. It
caress
is.
The divine detail. Now, another, I think, actually, where I wanted to really start was one of very early on. You say, one short sentence, emotional energy is the power source.
That's it.
Emotional energy is the power source.
That's it.
Well, I agree. Why is that so? Why is emotionally, why is it not just the plot?
This is how you know that emotional energy is the power source. You spend a day working. Been working away diligently, and suddenly you're tired, and you can't concentrate.
Right.
And you can't actually concentrate on the people around you, because that's going to require an emotional effort.
Right.
So where has that emotional effort been all along? Why do you have it no longer? Because if you've been doing your work properly, it's got into your work. It's got into the writing. It's gone into your summoning the emotion that you're giving to your character. I was writing a scene this morning in the novel I'm working on at the moment where a young man has to challenge the perceptions of a whole lot of older men. And he decides, as he looks at them, not to challenge them there and then. There's a room full of nine priests, and he's got to challenge their perceptions, with which he violently disagrees. He's got to challenge them strongly, and he decides, and we hear his thoughts, he decides not to take them on en masse, but to pick them off one by one. And he decides that, I thought, for reasons of expediency. And then I later thought, well, isn't it interesting that he decides that at the end of my day's writing? because to give him the amount of emotion he's going to need to challenge all these old guys... He's going to be very demanding. So tomorrow he may take them on en masse, you know.
But that's so funny, Frank, because I was, you know, first of all, I always believe that a work of writing, which is a piece of creation, which is all of life is creative, is such a relationship between the internal and the external, where the writer is sitting and what he's writing about. Or she's writing
about.
You're
not wrong.
Speaking of that, great, you've read A Movable Feast. I reference this book a lot because I love it.
One of the great books.
About writing it, and he writes in one scene about, I think he's writing about up in Michigan, and he said, I was hungry, so my character was hungry.
That's right.
And, you know, and it's such a small detail, but I do think that there's something about that. It's okay to use where you are and what you are if it brings an authenticity to it.
It's more than okay. It's actually essential. You have to do it. If you don't do it, your book will suffer from it. There's a very famous moment, and I know Finnegan's Wake is a special case, but there's a very famous moment when Samuel Beckett was acting over a period of a couple of months as a secretary to James Joyce. Joyce was having a series of eye operations.
Right.
And Joyce was assembling Finnegan's Wake, which is a massive stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
It basically takes place entirely in the nocturnal mind of his main character. And somebody arrived at the Joyce apartment and knocked at the door, and Joyce said, come in. and Beckett wrote it down. So when he's reading his notes back later
right.
to Beckett, to Joyce, he reads the words, come in. And Joyce said, stop, what was that? Beckett said, at that moment, he said, somebody knocked on the door and you said, come in, and I wrote it down. I suppose I better take it out. And Joyce said, no, leave it in. It happened too.
Excellent. But it's so true.
Oh, yeah. It happened too.
So true.
And in fact, many, many writers should have above their desks two signs. It happened too. And above it, they should have the sign that every writer should have. The Nike slogan. Just do it.
Yeah.
Shut up about it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Do the work. Because that's where the enjoyment is. People don't tell you this, Bill, but I'm sure you know it. The actual business of writing, the actual getting the story down on the page, is quite boring.
Can
be. What's wonderful is, A, having the idea, and B, then coming up, as you write, with all the little secondary and tertiary ideas, down to the power of eight, so to speak, the little discoveries, the little flashes of memory. I liken it to a pinball machine. You pull the handle, the ball goes loose, and boom, 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 it's hitting up lights here, there, and everywhere. That's what writing is like on a great day. And a great day like that comes by once about every 5 months.
Yeah,
the rest
you've
is slog.
You got to put the time in to get those.
Yeah. The rest is slog.
You got to be willing to go through it. And it's interesting, you mentioned the emotional source. Now, you actually spent some time, well, you were in broadcasting for a while, and but you actually did some theater. You did a kind of a one-man show of Joyce, didn't you?
I did. I did a show at the National Theatre in London called Rejoice, which was about the plot, if such it can be called,
right.
of Ulysses, but about the writing of Ulysses. And I now do these weekly podcasts, of course.
Yes,
where
that's
everybody,
excellent for those of you who are fans of Joyce or interested in becoming fans. I'm sorry, go ahead, Frank.
And that was a different kind of emotional expenditure. And I used to find at the end of a night that I was absolutely exhausted. It was an hour and a half show without a break. And it was completely memorized.
Yeah.
And, of course, as you know, on stage, you have to remember all your moves. You have to remember when to get down off the high stool, where to walk to downstage, how much to go back upstage with your back to the audience, how long to time it for. You've got to figure out all of these things. And then you turn around, and you're giving out this stuff all the time, and you're pouring it out of you. I found the correspondence between it and writing really quite interesting and quite arresting. I found the two had a lot in common in that it was the absolute giving out of emotional energy in a really exciting way. And I think, for me, that's very possibly the rush that is writing.
Oh,
is the actual emotional energy.
Yes, because I really think a story, even though there are sort of intellectual concepts at play, a story, for me, is the trace of an emotional journey. It's really just the...
Yes.
Well, you know that great line about writing by Doctorow, where he says, don't report on the fact of the rainstorm. Write what the experience of being in the rainstorm, which means what does it feel like? What is the emotional and sensate, but also emotional experience of being in the rainstorm? Because for a human being, I think emotion, I mean, you know what, if your protagonist is being chased by a villain, really, you're not writing the fact that he's being chased by this murderous villain. You're writing what it feels like to be chased by the murderous villain.
That's right. And you're writing it obliquely. You're writing it so that you're not hitting it on the nose.
That's right.
And in actual fact, if it's Ted Doctorow, I think no matter what he said, I would just follow it slavishly. I've been rereading Ragtime.
Oh, yeah?
And it's wonderful. Very interesting thing about Ragtime. I reread two books close together.
Uh-huh.
Recently, two American books, two great, great American books, Ragtime by Ted Doctorow, and the best, to my mind, the best book on war ever written by a man called Tim O'Brien.
Called
The Things They Carried.
Yes, sure.
The similarities between the two utterly disparate books are quite extraordinary, and it is all because they both recount the emotional experience. It's staggering how alike those books are.
I really think it's the only thing we care about is the emotional experience.
And the emotional power.
Is it the emotional? experience.
That's right.
You know, something I've been wanting to talk to you about.
Yes.
It's on my mind. For our listeners, they can hear Frank has a lovely voice, and a voice I'm sure you had from your youth, but you did train it in broadcasting. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I assume it
mm-hmm.
evolved, as does everything. And I'm someone who I always wanted to be able to sing beautifully, but I'm not really inclined that way, so I've sort of taught myself to talk instead because I thought that would be the next best thing. And I have always felt that there is a connection between when we say voice, as in our spoken voice, and the
yes.
development, and when we say voice in terms of our written voice. And you have a very strong writer's voice also. Do you feel that there is any connection between that?
I've never heard it put like that before, but I think you're absolutely right. And not only that, I have, I've had the interesting experience of people say to me many, many times, people who know me, who say to me, of course, when I'm reading one of your books, I'm actually hearing your voice.
Right, right.
And that really sort of nails your point, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's something, you know, for instance, as you developed your speaking voice,
yes.
and as I have tried to cultivate mine, it is as, and do you sing also? Do you sing ever publicly?
In order to broadcast well, I did some singing training with a wonderful teacher in Ireland who had been a major diva on the operatic stage.
And so
I got a lot of breath training. I got a lot of breath training there. I knew it wasn't for singing, thank God. The world was saved a great deal there.
Well,
but,
you and me both, Frank. But you know.
But the actual business of using one's voice. And here's the interesting thing, what you're now talking about here is, I have found more and more, and this may be the experience of having read my own audiobooks, but I have found more and more that the more I write, that I am actually, in my head, as I'm writing the actual copy on the page, putting down the prose, I'm hearing the audiobook reading
yes.
in my head. Yes. And it is the most enormous help. Because, for example, and this is one of my writing tips somewhere in the last 3 years, the last thing you should do before you hand in your book is read it out loud. So as I'm writing it nowadays, I'm almost reading it out loud. And I'm aware that I am trying to hit a middle ground between the written and the spoken word. And that is actually, I think, because of my broadcasting experience, that is where my writing voice is.
Yes, well, if you're like me, I mean, I was a voracious reader, and I'm sure you were too, but I was also
an
avid storyteller. And so when I sat down to write, you know, as a boy, really, when I began wanting to write stories, I could not but help to draw upon the experience of having a live person in front of me and having to use timing and economy to get that story told, because you can see right away when you've lost them, you know. And it was incredibly informative to me, and still is to this day. My public speaking, so it continues to inform my writing, I think.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, again, voice is voice. And you know yourself when you're speaking in public, and you have that marvelous moment, which very rarely happens, is that the perfect anecdote comes to you on your feet in the
yeah.
perfect form, and you deliver it in a way that you really like. That's when you really know the power of story, and they're sitting there, and they're watching you, and they're leaning forward, and they're listening to you every word. And you're making every word count as though it were a telegram. I think it was Hemingway said that the short story is a telegram you write to yourself, and you're paying for every word. And you're delivering this to the audience, and they're hanging on your every word. That, you see, and this is where it really interests me, that is a personal power available to everyone on earth.
It is. It's absolutely true. I'm so glad
you
said that.
The deep personal power.
Because it's there if you're willing, if you're interested in reaching for it. But it's absolutely
that's right.
there. Yeah.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
All right. So we have a few minutes for a couple more.
Okay.
I'm looking here. Now, this is a good one. Never let your characters answer each other directly. Don't do
don't
it.
Don't you love that?
Real life. Yes.
I love that. I love that. That is not originally mine.
Okay.
That comes from a correspondence between Henry James and Joseph Conrad.
Oh boy.
Who lived not that far away from each other in the south of England.
Yeah.
Conrad lived in the county of Kent, and Henry James lived in Rye on the Sussex coast. And they were friends, and they were correspondents, and they both shared a fond love for one of my favorite writers of all time, Robert Louis Stevenson. But in correspondence, they used to discuss writing technique and things you should and shouldn't do. And they made a pact with each other from one particular exchange forward, that from that day thenceforward, they would never again have their characters answer each other directly. Because if I bump into you in the street in Seattle, Bill, and I say to you, "Hi, Bill, how are you? How are you doing?" You say, "Do you know what I just found out?" See what I mean?
No, I know.
People do not answer each other directly.
No.
Absolutely not. When this tip went up, a friend of mine called me that day, a writer from England, a screenwriter, a good writer. He said to me, "I've just seen your writing tip." And he said, "You know," he said, "you're absolutely right," he said. "And I've just written a scene this morning," he said, "in which I tried it," he said. "And it's got more tension than any other scene in this movie I'm writing."
Yep.
And it's all about creating tension.
Yep.
Because we never do directly answer each other in speech. Not ever. You know, your kids come in, where were you? What's for dinner?
Right.
That's the answer. You say to your wife, "Where did you get these chops? Where did you get this steak?" She says, "What's wrong with them?"
Right.
She doesn't tell you down the street at the butcher's, you know.
Right.
She says, "What's wrong with them?"
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. And it creates a tension, it creates an energy, and it keeps the scene moving forward. It keeps it rolling. The motion you're looking for in writing narrative all the time is a rolling motion like a wagon. It must roll forward steadily. I like the business of writing to a freighter crossing the Atlantic. Because a freighter crosses the Atlantic in 5 days, it never does more than 16 to 20 knots, but it does it 24 hours a day.
Right.
So it's a rolling motion all the time. And the power, the tension in that motion comes when people do not answer each other directly. And besides which, it gives you wonderful possibilities because it makes people suspicious of each other.
Yeah, and it always, I mean, really, in dialogue, the best dialogue is the stuff where there's, well, I mean, you've just said it, but where the characters are not saying what they're saying.
Absolutely.
Because then, once again, we're back to the same thing we started with, which is not to describe the characters in detail, because when you don't have the characters say what they're saying, what they really mean, the audience decides for themselves, and that
That's
becomes
right.
theirs, and they believe it, and they trust it, and they don't have to take your word for it, because
That's
they've
right.
decided it, right?
Listen, all you got to do is listen to a play by David Mamet.
Yes, or, yeah.
And that's all there. That's dialogue at its best.
So, Frank, I know pretty soon I'm going to hear the little bird in my ear. Oh, there she is right now. So before I let you go, are these collected in any way, shape, or form anywhere?
Not yet, but we're thinking of putting them out as an e-book or going to a publisher with them because they've been such demand for them.
Well,
they go up on the... They go up on my Twitter feed, which is at FD by the word, and they're on my Tumblr feed, which is the same, and you can find them there anytime.
All right. Well, I encourage my listeners to go find these. They're just great. And Frank, as always, well, it's just a pleasure. I love talking to you. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Bill, the pleasure was mine entirely. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Have a good one. And folks, listen, next week, we're going to have on the suspense writer, Mr. Greg Olson, and I'm sure we're going to have a great chat. Until then, just as Frank always does, make sure that you do what you love and write what you love. Don't let your characters answer each other directly.